And this session is on faith and suffering, the death of a child. I've given you each an article. I hope everybody got one. I'm out now. Our machine is broken. So if there are others that come in and want an article, I will get them to you later. This article is written by Bruce Birch, who is a professor of Old Testament at Wesley Seminary in Washington and the father of a child who died at age 3 of leukemia. And he presented a conference at Children's Hospital, where I work as a chaplain, and also a follow-up conference for lay and clergy after that, presenting this paper. And I think it's a very good paper. It's very personal and an integration of his faith journey through his very difficult experience. So I wanted just to have that for you to read after you leave here. I'm going to give a basic outline of what he says, but there's really not enough time for you to read it. And the way in which he presents it is personal enough, so I think you'll get more out of it by reading his firsthand account. He begins by talking about the death of a child being a particularly offensive loss in our society. Because it is the end of life, as all death is, it's the end of life as we know it. It's a separation of relationship from a loved one. In the case of a child's death, it is a particularly heightened offense because we're a very youth-oriented society. We find a child's death to be unacceptable and unnatural. It's quite different from the death of an older person. And this level of unacceptability creates both emotional crises and spiritual crises within parents and within each of us. And I think today that we each come here from our own communities of faith, and whether or not we have experienced this, it is something that we will come in contact with through our communities. It's a very common thing for a parent to have lost a child. Through a miscarriage, that is a kind of a loss that has been given very little attention in our grief literature. But that is something that many women have experienced, as well as the loss of young children, infants, on up through, young adults and older children. The crisis that this provokes is an emotional one that commands your first attention, and the kinds of feelings that overwhelm a parent at that point are very, very deep and overwhelming. And they include just a myriad of feelings, but some of them being pain, the sadness of that loss, the anger, perhaps a sense of disbelief and shock that this could happen, a numbness that a person feels at the first of this reality. There's also just a tremendous amount of confusion of feelings, of doubt and despair, of hopelessness, of aloneness. That is perhaps one of, if not the primary feeling. I am alone in this. And even couples find this to be a very difficult experience to go through. The percentage of marriages that do not survive the death of a child are 80-90% because of this separation that everyone experiences in this. And it makes it difficult for a couple to really communicate with each other. And it's very important to know that and to be able to support the individual members of the marriage, and not assume that the couple is able to do it for each other, because that is rarely the case. The death of a child is something that one never gets over, and yet in our society, we expect people to get over it. And particularly I think we see that in our churches. After a certain point, maybe a year after a child's death, if you want to bring that up, People look at you funny if the parent starts to remember something about their child, or just talk about how depressed they're feeling. It's a very hard thing for most people to really listen to that and to accept that as a normal, healthy thing. They think, you should be over this. Why don't you just move on with life? And that's a stereotype that I don't think is very helpful at all. I don't think you ever get over it. You learn to cope with it and hopefully to find support communities that allow you to live with that reality and to continue to live with the memory of your child, to affirm the life of that child that is an ongoing reality for you. That child doesn't die. That child is always a part of your life. And then the emotional crisis is often very intertwined with a spiritual crisis, and that's what we've focused on primarily the last two sessions and want to talk a good bit about today also. The question being, how can I find God in this experience? When I'm feeling all these feelings, where is God in this? And often the feelings of anger and alienation, aloneness, are projected onto God, and we blame God and hold God responsible for that tragedy. And that gets back to what we talked the first session, this image of a punisher God that is in our scriptures very strongly. And at a moment like this, is brought up. Somehow those images are early ones that we often learn as children from our parents and in our early Sunday school experiences. And when you're going through a crisis, you fall back on your earliest kind of learnings. And often that image of a punisher God, even though you might intellectually say, I don't believe in it, you still feel that this is what God is doing to me. And it's a very hard thing to be honest about that. I think the beauty of Kushner's book is that he allows people to be honest about that. There's nothing wrong about feeling it, because we've been exposed to those images of God throughout most of our life. So it's not realistic for us to expect that we're not going to feel that at certain points. But what Kushner offers and what Bruce Birch offers and many others is alternative views of God. And I've listed some of them. We'll get into a little later, but just to give a summary, God as hearer of our pain, God as a life giver out of death, and God as a sufferer with us. The second image of God that I think causes a tremendous amount of pain is the image of God as omnipotent, a God who causes this sort of tragedy to happen. And we saw, just to lift up that scripture in 2 Samuel, the image of God as bringing upon the death of the child, David's child, because of a punishment for David's sin. We have been exposed to images of God as a healer, as a granter of miracles. And that at a time of great turmoil, we often rely on this. Our prayer life seems to rotate around, you know, wanting a miracle, praying for a miracle, asking support from our community of faith for healing. And that is a very difficult thing to reconcile with the actual death of a child. Because here we have this belief that God is able to heal this child, and yet God has not answered our prayers. And I think what we need to do is to really rethink what it means to believe in an all-powerful God. As Shumi had offered that image of God's power as being all-loving, the infinite lover, rather than the infinite magician who can somehow change life situations. And I think that's a really helpful image, so that we don't have to relinquish our belief that God is all-powerful. But it's a matter of looking at in what ways do we conceive of God's power. And I think as a lover is our primary focus. The second really very helpful image for me of God is one of hearing our feelings. hearing our pain when we're going through something that's very difficult. The Psalms are very much an expression of this and are very honest in their feelings of anger, despair, bitterness, contempt, hatred, just the whole gamut of very honest human feelings. And yet they also are very honest in their feelings of trust and confidence and praise in God. Somehow they are able to do that together. In the same psalm, you have a beginning maybe in a despair and an ending in a note of praise. We found that also yesterday talking about black spirituals, how they're able to encompass the whole range of human feelings and human faith experience within their expressions. And that, I think, is a tribute to the belief that we have in God as hearer. God is able to hear all of our feelings and does not censor us for those. I think in our churches today, we often have censor our own, you know, feelings and somehow have a distrust that anger towards God is acceptable or doubt, you know, doubt as to God's presence is an acceptable feeling. Well, I would say that it is, and that God is able to be with us in that and not leave us alone. A third image of God that is very helpful is God as life giver. Now, this is a very hard thing to see at the time of a death, particularly a child's death, because often our prayers have been centered on asking for this life to be given, to be continued, and it isn't. But the symbols and the belief of the church has been that the resurrection that comes through the death of Jesus is the final word. It doesn't take away the pain, and that's the thing that's very important to realize, that believing in the resurrection doesn't mean that there is no pain associated with living. But it gives us a perspective beyond that to affirm that at one point, ultimately, we will know life eternal, and that there is nothing that ultimately separates us from our loved ones and from God's love. I think, you know, as Christians, looking at the life of Jesus is very, very important at this point. And the life of the man Jesus is one way to look at that. He spent his time mostly with people who were suffering. He was with the poor. He was with those who were sick. He was with the lepers. He was with the outcasts who were emotionally suffering. And he didn't always heal them either. There were examples in Scripture where he was able to heal, but a lot of times Jesus was just present with them and gave them a sense of their dignity as human beings and their importance to God as people. And that is not dependent on their circumstance in life. And then, of course, when we look at Jesus' life and death, we realize that God didn't save Jesus from tremendous amount of suffering and death. And even though Jesus is recorded in Scripture, asked for that in the Garden of Gethsemane, he prayed to be delivered from that. As we all turn to God in those times, asking for deliverance, that was not Jesus' experience. And I think that helps to see that God did not do that for Jesus, and that yet he was with Jesus through it. And through that whole death came the life of the resurrection and the life of the faith community which we celebrate. Again, the finality that God's life and love wins out. Now, I think the last thing I want to look at is the role of the church community. And I believe that mirrors very closely the role of, you know, how we perceive God. That we as disciples, as members of the church, are asked to be God's witnesses to each other. And particularly at a time when a person doesn't feel God's presence with them. And that is a particularly unique experience when you're going through a death of a very close loved one, that there is a sense of emptiness, a vacuum, an alienation. What we can do and be for each other is God's witness and the presence of God through the human community. And I would just repeat those themes that I expressed earlier. By listening to each other, primarily, by hearing that pain, by allowing that pain to come into us, and in a sense that is by suffering with a person, because it is a great deal to listen to another person's pain. And it takes, it's not an easy thing. And that's the reason I think that we shut it off. We don't want to listen to other people's pain. We have our own pain. But that really is what our mission is, I feel, in the church, to allow that suffering to come into us and to share that. And there's a sense where being surrounded by other people who share your suffering releases some of that burden. It certainly releases the burden of aloneness, which is one of the most devastating feelings. And another primary role of the church community is to affirm the faith symbols, to hold up the belief in the resurrection at a point when emotionally a parent isn't feeling that. A parent doesn't feel like celebrating a life of a child. And Bruce Birch talks about this, particularly in his own experience of his daughter's death, that he felt that without the community of his church, he and his wife would not have been able to see that Christine's life had been a gift and was and to make her service of celebration rather than a service of mourning in the context of the funeral. And they struggled a great deal with that. And even 10 years later, when he is writing this paper, he said, I think without that community of faith, we never would have been able to see that vision, that her life was so important, and God's life is ultimately so important and the only reality. And without people to talk with him and just to be life-giving to he and his wife, that they would have been really burdened down with the feelings and the tragedy, the despair that they went through. So I think in the best sense, the church can be a giver of perspective, can celebrate the whole range of life with people and allow them to see the life that goes on in spite of death, and to help them look into the future and to realize that there will be a point at one time when those feelings will be less intense and that there will be more of a sense of God's presence with them and a really heartfelt sense of thankfulness for the life of the child. And lastly, the community is one of love. I think that is very important, the kind of fellowship that we create with each other through our churches, the small kindnesses that can be done, and they are often the ones that mean the most. And I guess I've heard many parents say, you know, they need help with the small things, with the kids, the babysitting, the errands, the cooking. They feel like, you know, at that point of when they're really dealing with a tragedy, they don't want to deal with that. Their emotions have really taken over, and they need to be given the space to be with their family. And I find that the church community can be most helpful in that way, in taking over for a family and helping them just get through those first months and even that first year, which is a very hard thing, to just give them the extra lift they need in the ongoing life that they and responsibilities they have as family members and parents. I think it was stop there. I wanted to give a good amount of time for any discussion. And I think perhaps one way to focus that would be on our role as a community. And if there are some of you here who have experienced this kind of loss, I would really appreciate your being able to share with us what helped you in your faith community, through your family. What were the things that were positive? And also, what were the things that weren't positive? And how can we learn from each other so that as we go into our faith communities, we can be more sensitive givers of love to one another? I want to begin.
I'll go ahead and start as someone who has experienced the loss of two children. And I think it's, you know, one of the things that over time has become important for me to know is that my wife and I work through those experiences very differently. And I'd be interested to read Bruce's paper since I know him and come out and stay, you know, out of a professional role in that. I think being male means that I did almost all my work intellectually, at least I thought I did, and tried to come to terms with this in terms of getting everything lined up intellectually to make sense of it. That was not the path my wife took at all. And I think she's more able to live with the open-endedness of it as someone who was the nurturer of that life, able probably to deal with her anger and emptiness in a way that was much closer to who she was as a person. And so, you know, I think it was important in our case that we each had room to do that. She wouldn't buy my stuff, and I couldn't understand hers. And somehow there was space to do that. The other thing that is very interesting, I'm now 43 years old, and this is now 20-some years since the first one, and 16, 18 years since the second one. And I'm discovering that a lot of the grieving I should have done then never got done. Mm-hmm. And that stuff sits there, I think, coming out sideways until you deal with it straight ahead. And Sandy's had some of the same experience, so that, you know, what you say about always being there, it's very important that other people let you talk about that, let you get emotional, and let you be a basket case. So those were just learnings for us.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Do you think that your wife, in perhaps being more direct with her feelings in the beginning, was able to, is her grieving been less intense as the years have gone by, or do you both feel that?
Well, it's hard to answer that, because part of what we fool ourselves with is that you're ever over. I think that's really important for people to hear that. My wife is a nurse, and is now back in school to get her Bachelor of Science degree. And she just has gone through some prenatal and OB care and all that stuff again. And she says, really interesting, the day they did that, of the feelings that came, that washed back. And the first child, about, you know, as near as we can reconstruct things, the doctor probably, he just simply misdiagnosed that my wife was having a child. She was early, and he just was incompetent. And the anger never got dealt with about that. And he came in and said, well, it's just God's will. Mm-hmm. And if we had been smart, we just said, well, we'll see what a lawyer says.
That's right. No,
but we were in seminary at that time, and it happened during Wednesday, Holy Week, so there's a lot of images that were helpful to me intellectually. But I think it's, you know, it's been good for us to say, well, we'll deal with it as we can and when we can.
How was the community that you were involved in at that time, or since then, helpful or not helpful?
We were in seminary the first trip through, and the congregation where we worked, the pastor was very much a hearer of pain. That was very helpful. The seminary community was disjointed enough and not close enough so that some who knew us were supportive and the others we just slipped right on through, which was okay, I think. At least I've never felt otherwise. Family was helpful. Again, with just space, mainly.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't remember at that time a lot of theologizing being done. One person did say, I think very insightfully, that this, someday you'll understand how this will help you preach the gospel.
How did that feel at the time?
What?
How did that strike you at the time?
Registered intellectually, but that was the safest place, I suppose. Then in the second case, I was the leader of the community because I was pastor. Congregation gave us a lot of space, and we're very supportive again. And I don't recall, other than, when we needed something, like you said, little things. A friend wrote to us, which was one of the most helpful things, and said, we don't know how to pray, except that God will get you through it. That was helpful.
Did you find that your friends gathered around you, or did you have a sense of people drawing back from you?
No, I would say drawing around us. And, that's always, that to us has been important and helpful. And I think, as you can tell even as I talk, my grieving is still going on.
Yeah.
That's because I didn't deal with it. And nobody encouraged that.
My reaction to that might be that I think if I remember your congregation, I would say, I think the congregation has been throwing you in this role of how he handles it is the way that we're supposed to, you kind of model the model there. And you must have felt it too, so that you couldn't really, you had to show strength, so to speak, and that you were coping with this debt. Don't you think that you felt that?
It might be, except that this happened, I think, the Tuesday before confirmation of Pentecost.
Was this an infant?
Mm-hmm. When the child was born, with the massive birth defects, and so we had 3 months in which to prepare for an inevitable death. But I preached that confirmation sermon, and I'm emotional anyway. So, they let me fall apart. So that, I think they let me do that.
I could speak to that as well, having lost a child at 16, and through sudden loss and no preparation. And church is still anguish time. And I think we as Christians perhaps need to understand that for those, no matter what the loss is, but particularly for children, because that's the one time of the week when we're always together. And Sunday is the time where you do come as that family, and you are there. And when you mention confirmation, I will not go through a confirmation ever. I'm never going to be the same person. Baptisms, we women are known to cry for baptisms, but my heart breaks. Confirmation, there's never a time within the church celebration where the absence is more poignant, and most assuredly during communion. And if you look at what we say and sing during the liturgy with all the saints, or all the angels, and that takes on meaning like you never knew before. And there are hymns that I find very difficult. Children of the Heavenly Father, I usually chew the inside of my mouth because I can't get through it. There is a verse of A Mighty Fortress that I do not sing, because it talks about losing not only your child but your spouse, and I've also experienced that. And so that for those of us who up to that point take those hymns and they have become part of us, those who are grieving and will do so for the rest of their lives, that is a time where spirit living is very precious, but it is also very difficult. And I am a true believer in spirit living, so I want you to remember with me. I want you to let me keep talking about this crazy kid I had, and who is still very much a part of me. I want other people who knew him to say, do you remember when Carl did that dumb thing? Or the same for my husband. And I treasure people who will dare to do that. Because for those of us who have grieved, I know it's hard for me to explain, but up to the moment of my son's death, there was a space between the times I was joyous. I mean, when I celebrated, and I was happy. And then when I got sad, I got sad. But there were spaces in between, if you can understand what I mean. Now there are no spaces. Those two are just hand in glove. There is no celebration in life that is meaningful, but there is the other side, that the absence is very much there. And I'm not too sure, but that isn't reality. My oldest son was just married in May. And needless to say, it was a joyous celebration, but it was anguish in its missing. So that you have that two-edged, and you go through life that way, and it is very difficult because you never know when it's going to hit you. You can prepare for birthdays, you prepare for Christmas, you prepare for anniversary times, you get into a situation and whammo, without the merest preparation, something triggers a memory. And it's like taking a band-aid off an ulcer. And you are very vulnerable and human and a puddle.
Have you found people are able to be with you and listen to your emotions? I think the times when people cry, those sorts of times, have you found people supportive in the community?
I have been very fortunate. At the time of my son's death, we were in a predominantly black congregation, a very small congregation, and a group of people for whom suffering is an understanding and acceptance of who God is, and not in a fatalistic way, not without wanting to change, but allowing, permitting, and holding up. There is a prayer in the Krishna book that says we cannot merely pray to you, O God, and then it goes on to say, but we must do. We cannot merely pray to you, God, to end prejudice, but we must do. We cannot merely pray to you, God, to end war, but we must do. In other words, we're translating it like what you were saying this morning about cheap grace. No, we cannot talk and pray about justice. We cannot talk and pray for someone. You know, if you're close to me and tell me I'm going to pray for you, that means a lot to me. But if you are close geographically, I would like you to translate that. Thank you very much. In other words, it's a trickle down.
A physical
presence. It's
not presence.
Just a head up. And we Lutherans are real good about chin up, and we have trouble getting it trickled down.
Churches always will pray for their members, but it's much more difficult to physically spend time listening and crying with someone. I know that experience I've heard many parents say is the most moving, is just when their friends feel enough to allow themselves to experience that pain with them, and just to be there in that together. As members of churches are... Oh, go ahead.
I identify with the part of the church community that ministers to people, and particularly of a couple who lost a son who was about 20 years of age. I did not know the son, but in the 3 years I've known the mother, there's been at first it was almost a constant sharing of reference to her son, to Sam and did a lot of listening. My wife still does a lot of listening on the phone. And so it almost seems like a Mormon remembrance. And it has been transferred to in your reference to the devastation to the marriage, it seems to have turned into a bitterness toward her husband, who isn't, I don't find him near as bad a guy as that she makes him out to be. He isn't of our church, he's of a different faith, it's a mixed marriage. Mm-hmm. So is there a point where a person needs to confront the person and say, well, you need to get a hold of yourself, or should we continue to let her pour her heart out?
That's a very hard, you have to know that person and the situation, I think, to make any kind of judgment. It's such a unique thing. I think everybody has a different way of grieving, and the timing is unique to that person. I would think maybe the minister or close friends of the family who maybe know that family well could have a better sense of what, I mean, there are such things as unhealthy grief reactions that, and usually that comes from not being able to express your grief. You know, if it's delayed, if it's really ignored or denied, it can come out in pretty pathological ways. So I would think that any encouragement of feeling is basically a healing process. And I think maybe people who have not experienced that loss don't have a sense of the intensity of the feeling and the need to talk and the time, the time that it takes, years and a lifetime. It never ends. And it's something you never understand unless you've experienced it. And that's part of the problem of communicating with other people in the church.
2 years ago, John Schramm had a thing here where he read something from a physician who was going through a lot of pain, and then he asked us the question, how would you respond to this man? And we spent an hour trying to come up with what things could we say to him to make him feel better or whatever. And for Schramm set us up. But the bottom line for him was, when it was all over, he said, the question I asked you was, how would you respond? And the assumption that we were making is that we would respond by words rather than by presence. In other words, the point was, can the church be a place where people can come to speak? And to speak and not feel as though they're going to be pushed out or judged or whatever. And I'm wondering if as a members of a Christian community, that's perhaps one of the best things we can do.
Mm-hmm.
But it's also, I think, the thing we're most afraid to do, because it's like we have the right thing to say so that that person goes away feeling better. In other words, if I can say the right thing to you, if you tell me a painful thing, then you'll feel better and I'll feel better and everything is fine.
Yeah, yeah. I've heard many people say that. It's better just to be there and not talk. Just be there.
But sit then there. Other people will say, well, I don't know what to say, so I stay away.
Yeah,
and they become like a leper.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's fear too, because we don't want to be where they are.
Mm-hmm.
We don't want to feel that overwhelming grief. I think the loss of a child must be the most painful loss there is. I've not been through that, thank God, but I just can't imagine, you know, what people must feel. And I think that people probably want to do the right thing, they want to say the right thing, they want to be with people who are feeling that pain, but I think there must be a real fear of, gee, you know, I would never want to feel that myself, and I think that's part of why we sometimes aren't there when we're needed.
Definitely, yeah. Yeah.
I think it's also a little bit of guilt because we have healthy children ourselves, and that we haven't felt that pain. We feel guilty because they have and we can't take on their pain in any way.
I've heard, though, that parents really appreciate knowing the children, their own kids' age, you know, and continuing that, to live, you know, with those children. You know, we think, I think, that sometimes if we stay away, it will keep them from being hurt, because then they won't see our children and think of their children. Well, that's not true. They want to think of their children. They want to remember the friendships that their child had. And so it's a gift to be able to share your family life with the parent of a lost child.
Does it happen that sometimes the death of a child will separate the family rather than draw them together?
Oh, yes.
Very much so.
Why? It happened in my family, that's why I'm asking.
Well, do either of you want?
I'll respond for the children, first of all. I have three surviving children. And at the time of my son's death, my oldest son was 2 weeks from going to college. My daughter was to be a sophomore in high school. And then I had a seven-year-old. And for children to view parents who are normally supposed to be in control, one thing a child should be able to predict in life is that at least their parents have got it together. It's one of the agonizing things of divorce, clearly. I mean, suddenly they don't, literally. When a child dies and both parents are grieving and many times in isolation, because what we don't understand is what you were saying earlier, is that we grieve so individually. And the rest of the world has an expectation on how we should grieve, for one thing. So that all of a sudden you do that yourself as a grieving parent. You look at your spouse and you think, my word, you know, why doesn't that make him feel that way? Or why is she acting that way? And it sounds irrational, it is, but your world is so upside down. It's so chaotic. And then there are the children watching this. And the children, in their own way, depending on who that child was in their lives, are trying to make kind of some sense. Not only do they have to deal with the fact that they lost a sibling, but then they have to deal with what all hell is breaking loose with their parents. And none of it do they understand. And there's not one person who is going to make an equation out of that that makes a one and one make two. So that for families to go away from one another because of what they don't understand and this inability to articulate because of the absolute desperate, agonizing despair, depending on what the circumstances are or how communication takes place. And that's why you have a 90 percentile divorce rate, and why many times families just go different directions, because you feel so isolated, like no one understands who I am in this. It's so complicated. And those families who are able to stay together, and I have been very fortunate in that, but you work at it, and you work at it hard, and you talk a whole lot. But then again, teenagers, there has been a lot borne out in research recently. Teenagers do not talk. If they have lost a sibling, they simply do not verbalize. And it makes it very difficult as a parent. It's very scary, because you don't know where they're at.
Have you seen your kids as they've gotten older start to talk about that?
My children did a lot non-verbally. My oldest son played a lot of music right away. And I do not listen to Poulenc's Gloria or parts of the Messiah ever. But for me, that was his helping for resurrection. And it would just blare through the house. I mean, and I knew when that happened that that was something he had to hold on to. My daughter would write things, seldom say them, but she got into a freshman writing course, and the first assignment, this was a year after her dad died and 3 years after her brother died, the prof says, write something about a loss in your life. And she comes to me and she says, what do I write about? What do I choose? And some other kid came up to her and says, you know, the only thing I can write about is my dog. I mean, I don't know what, you know. And here's my daughter wondering how. And in the process of writing, she was able to do an incredible amount of release. And my six-year-old, who is now 12, at the age of 12, has had two major deaths in his life. And fortunately, he's a very articulate young man. And he wrote a little book the first Easter after his brother's death. And it's the funniest looking thing you ever saw, but you know, if he found these scrap pieces of paper and then just folded them together, and it's called My Brother Died. And what he did was go through everything that he remembered, and this was done totally on his own, and drew pictures of how he envisioned the truck that came around the corner that hit the car, drew a picture of the young man who did survive the car crash in the hospital, and ended up by saying, you would have cried too if this happened to you, because it was not permissive for him as a little boy to cry. And if you think of what your children get when they go to school, every fall, what does the teacher say to you, assigned to the kids? Write what happened last summer, or write about your family. And those are two questions that still tear my 12-year-old apart. When someone says, who is in your family? Well, that's another question, you know. Mm-hmm. How many children do you have? When someone asks me that, mm-hmm. right? If you're a parent, always. And for children, it's very difficult. But as time goes on, because we do talk, we don't talk as if, you know, sepulchrally, but we do a lot of laughing about crazy memories. And we do laughing about sad memories, too, sometimes. And we cry about those. But we do a lot of remembering. And they come at different times, and they go at different times. But everybody has to find their own way, and there is, we have to give space for that and encourage it. And those of you who know families who have lost children, not only look at the parents, but look at those surviving siblings. They are really aching.
They often are the real victims, aren't they? Yeah. Parents don't have the energy to
do. And then there's jealousy that comes in, you know? I mean, if the parent is continually grieving over the lost child, well, then this other child, can you imagine if you're the child after a while? You know, I'm really tired about hearing about him. I mean, I can see where that would be real natural.
Yeah.
You know, will you please get that over with?
Does that answer your question at all?
Mine?
Uh-huh.
Mm-hmm. Well, for sure.
What did you
to
mean?
Some extent, yes.
What?
But the thing that I think hurt my son the most was that the mother, his wife, would have nothing to do with the funeral. She wouldn't go to visitation. That was all left to him. And he was away at the time. The child was driven over by a school bus, second grader, and killed instantly. And I think she still carries within herself that hurt, because she was never able to cry. She was never able to release that hurt. And she was surrounded by a lot of church members and school friends and teachers and everything. My son grieved very deeply and was, I think he has gotten on, but the only thing he remarked about a year ago was that, mother, it's so strange because nobody ever mentions Todd anymore. It's just as if I never had a son. And I'm guilty of that too, because I was afraid. I mean, I just didn't know if he wanted to be reminded about it or not. Mm-hmm. But this has helped.
That release of feeling, I think, is real important to really, like Charlie said, encourage people to release their feelings. Don't be afraid to see somebody cry. You're doing them the best kindness you can. You can't protect people from those feelings. Often it's so hard to allow that to happen. And if family members can't do that for each other, and if church members can't do that for each other, you can get really lost in between the cracks and just go on for years. And that's very, very common.
Just to underline some of the things Shuni was saying about why people divorce or separate as a result of the loss of a child. I've done some reading about bereaved parents, and it strikes me that John Bowlby has written a really good book on loss and attachment that is a clinical examination, but a very good examination of what happens to people when they grieve, and the aloneness that Shuni talked about, and the way in which people are caught up in their, in trying to recover their own balance, their own sense of self, that they can't accept anymore because it's been thrown so off kilter. They're so busy trying to reconstruct that that they're devoting energy to that, and they can't, in the meantime, be sensitive to one another's needs and look at each other and begin to find ways to create space to listen to one another, because they are absorbed. And the other thing that he points out, he uses the phrase conspiracy of silence, because and I think that's very poignant, because it points out the way in which not only the surrounding community, but even the most intimate people in a marital relationship can't deal directly with their feelings about the loss. And sometimes therapy can be an effective way to do that. Maybe a minister can be an effective way to do that. Maybe just being quiet together for a long enough time can be an effective enough way to do that. It struck me before when people were mentioning that, that Job's friends came and sat with him even for several days, I think it was 7 days, before they even spoke to him. And I think that's the biblical precedent for being present to one another in community.
Mm-hmm. Often in a church community, that the church does rally around a family for a short amount of time, but then afterwards kind of doesn't, and that's real hard. I'm not sure it's possible for a church to sustain that degree. I doubt that's really true, but I don't think that church members always realize that the grieving perhaps can even be more acute 3 or 4 months after the death than at the actual time, and that it's more important to space out our friendships, and rather than, you know, be there all the time at the beginning and then leave the person alone for the rest of the time. And maybe too, as you know, we work with the deacons or who, in whatever informal or formal ways the church decides to provide support, to be aware of that grieving process and the need for ongoing support at crucial times. Yeah.
Something has just struck me that I didn't really put that much credence to. Our girls are twins, and they started as freshmen in high school this year. And in our community, it's two school districts going together, so to speak. And so there were many kids they didn't know. And interestingly enough, the kids came home and said they had met a girl who says she's a twin, and her twin died 7 years ago. And it's just hitting me, really, why this girl probably found out that they were twins, and I think she's talked about her twin with them. Now, you know, the tradition at the end of the year with the yearbook, how you write in it. And it struck me in the car driving out, I was reading it, and here's this kid. Remember, I am also a twin. Mm-hmm. And so she, at 7, is still, here she is at 14, she is still working this through, and I'll fire up my kids. You know, to do some more support.
That would be a lonely thing. There are very few twins.
It must be, because she appreciates so much how fortunate they are. Because I know, I think, because they are only two children, that it has, when they were little and they were getting really sick, at points I think, oh, please don't separate these two. Because of their specialness of being twins.
Yeah.
It's really
a problem. That's I've seen parents in the hospital when a twin died, and it's a very unique. I mean, every death is unique, but that's even a more unique situation. There are other parents who've lost children, but there are very few parents who've lost children who are twins, and that sense of isolation is more intense. So. It's important to know how important maybe your girls can be for her.
They might turn into triplets.
Are there any other experiences that you've had in your churches or just your friends or personally of how you see things helping people in that sort of situation or not? What you'd like to change? Yeah.
Well, this is just to kind of affirm the idea about talking about children that die and including everyone. In our neighborhood one year, about six of us had babies all within a couple months of each other, and one of the mothers who had thought she could never have a child and became pregnant, was her child that died of sudden infant death, and he was about 2 months old, and she had a funeral, and I know at the beginning we all, it was really devastating because we all had these little infants, and she had a regular funeral, and all the other neighborhood kids came, and at the time we were kind of wondering if that was the appropriate thing, but, and then we moved away right afterwards, and even when I see her now, though, and we talk about Craig, and the other children remember Craig, and she has told us how helpful that was to have the children involved and to have us talking about him, you know, rather than just kind of was a baby that died and we'll try to forget it and go on with it.
Do you find that hard?
I don't think it's as hard for me because we moved away right away, and so I sort of, when I think of the neighborhood and what went on, that's sort of my first remembrance, and so I can talk to her perhaps easier than the other people who kind of, life went on, you know, and things changed. Mm-hmm. But I think she really appreciates that, you know, when I tell her, oh, Eric remembers Craig, you know, mm-hmm. Things like that.
You know, along with this, I think, though, we need to remember that unique as losing a child or whatever it might be, that others suffer other kinds of loss that is, you know, from my perspective, perhaps even more devastating. I think of a young guy in our congregation, relatively young, his early 30s, a paraplegic as a result of a motorcycle accident. That's a reminder of a loss that's sustained. And the feelings families go through of that in terms of so it's important, I think, that we not you know, those of us who walk through these various losses to realize that it's probably out of our woundedness that we have something to offer if we will let that be a gift to us and to them makes us more sensitive. I think that's what that person meant about maybe being able to preach the gospel on another day. To know that others suffer, and if one has not suffered more than another, that's not the issue. For me, that's been really important learning.
Not to put a priority on any particular.
You know, it may well be that the loss of a spouse that one has been particularly close to may be far more devastating to one than.
Yeah, and I think that's a real connecting link. Loss is a part of all of our lives, and it always will be. And that's the one way the community can really bond together. Yeah.
On the other hand, the same thing, I think the danger we might also do is when the, almost kind of inversely, we say as the older the person is who dies, the less our grief will be. Mm-hmm. Assuming that an 80-year-old grandfather dies and we don't understand, gee, why is everybody so upset? I mean, the old guy lived in old age. And these people are falling apart. And thinking that grief is any less than another.
And it's back to our judging, you know, and if we can get away from judging and just be able to listen and accept, we'd be better off. I think it's about time for lunch. I wanted to just offer, though, if there's some who would like to continue any dialogue in smaller groups, we would have time for that later on. We could arrange that. Thank you.